Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli this week, and we're also going to have a special guest from the realms of sociology. And our guest is going to be Alice Cepeda. She's from the University of Southern California. And Alice, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, welcome, Alice, to Science Studio. And please tell us a little bit about what you do and how you got into it.
Okay, so I am a college professor. I am currently an assistant professor in the School of Social Work at USC. I am a sociologist by training, so that means that I actually received a Bachelor's of Science in sociology. I got a Master's of Science in sociology, and then I got a PhD in sociology from the City University of New York Graduate Center.
So you're well-trained.
Very well-trained.
Before we get into
that. I'm a true sociologist by heart.
Good. But how did you get to that point? When you were a little girl, did you dream one day of, and I'll let it now, you're sort of really interested in addiction, but when you were 10, 9, 8, 11, whenever, what drove you into a science-oriented career?
When I was 10 and 11, I really, to believe it or not, I wanted to be a journalist. So I always had that dream of becoming a journalist. I was very interested in politics, so I figured, you know, there's some way of integrating politics and journalism. I am a second-generation Mexican-American from San Antonio, Texas. My parents are immigrants from Mexico, from San Luis Potosí. And, you know, my parents had grade school educations. They were not college educated. They didn't even graduate from high school. But somehow they instilled in us, you know, the importance of an education. I still ask them sometimes, you know, how do we get through school? You know, neither of them speak English. But I guess through my siblings, we kind of pushed each other and motivated each other to graduate from high school. And I think what was one of the culminating turning points was that I was going to move to Houston to get a bachelor's in journalism because, make a long story short, I did not get the financial aid that I was going to get at the University of Houston. I stayed in my university, the University of Texas at San Antonio, and I took a social problems class, undergrad sociology class. And the professor assigned a reading called Ishmael. And it was a book about a gorilla who is viewing society from his perspective, right? And I think that was one of the things that really, you know, just changed my direction. And I said, well, sociology, what is sociology? So, you know, in the simplest terms, how it was explained to me was that it was the study of society. And growing up as a second generation in a primarily disadvantaged community in San Antonio, I was exposed to all kinds of ills and challenges that families and young people were facing. And I think that was really what changed my whole perspective. And I guess at that time I got turned off by politics too.
So sociology, social ills, social problems, that's an enormous area.
Yeah.
I mean, almost everything we do is a part of a sociology sort of perspective. It could be a gestalt in that area. What made you get so interested in the concept which you're now an expert in, and that is addiction?
One of the things was that my father was, when I was growing up, was, I would say, an alcoholic. He drank a lot. Drugs were never around us, but they were around my peers. And some of the peers that now I've come to realize that, you know, never really made it out of those initial years of experimenting with drug use. So to me, it was something that was affecting our community or my community. And I thought it was something that was not being focused on a lot. And I always seemed to think that I work with a population that other people don't want to work with.
Like the Salvation Army.
Yes. Yeah. So drug users, right? And I think they're very stigmatized. But as a sociologist, I have always been trained in talking to people, not sitting in my office, you know, and kind of pontificating about theories and trying to understand drug users from that perspective, but trying to understand drug users from their perspectives.
So you're out on the street.
Out on the streets.
So what do you learn?
Well, one of the things is that drug users are not any different from you and I. But they have been dealt life experiences that some of us have had other opportunities in. I don't think that drug users or individuals who are experimenting with drugs say, well, I'm going to use drugs and I'm going to become an addict. You know, I think there's other ills that and other experiences that contribute to this use. And I've learned that a lot of the populations that I work with, primarily Mexican Americans, who are not just marijuana users, because marijuana is commonly used, but we're talking about heroin users, cocaine users, and more recently, in my most recent work, crack users in Mexico City, is that the challenges they face create anxiety, create depression, and I think drug use is kind of one of the outlets for individuals to use to forget about some of the challenges that they have to face. And I guess one example, you say, you know, what have I learned? One of my most recent projects that I'm working with young men who had a history of gang membership was that felonies, having a felony as an adolescent under 21 years of age, has long-term consequences. And so...
So you mean a felony for drug use, which is
primarily,
debatable, right?
Yes, primarily these are felonies for drug use, you know, drug possession. It's not even intent to sell.
I grew up in New York City, by the way,
okay.
Near City College in the 60s, and with drugs everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And people made choices. Mm-hmm. People said, no, that's too damaging. And other people just, I mean, there were suicides and, oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
The question I always had was, if you're in the middle of all that, how do you make the right choice? I think that's what you're saying.
Yes. And I think we have to remember that context is very important and infrastructure or what's going on historically in those communities that may contribute to somebody choosing a life of, you know, having a job.
Well, you know, in New York City in the 60s, plenty of wealthy people, not down and out people, were in the middle
mm-hmm.
of that.
Yeah, and I guess in my experience with families, for instance, in San Antonio, it was very prosperous. You know, I think when we're talking about the 60s, right? There was a lot of manufacturing jobs there. In the late 80s,
it was also cool to experiment.
Oh, yeah. In the 60s, it was very cool to experiment, which brings me to another point. The baby boom generation is something that is very – it's a very hot topic right now in drug addiction, you know, because the baby boom generation had experienced drug use, right? And so many of them are still, you know, not to the extent of problematic drug use, but they're still engaging in – you know, dabbling in...
Messing
in,
around.
Yeah, in marijuana use.
So when does it become a problem then? Only when the messing around has societal implications outside of the immediate circle of the people involved.
Well, there's a theory in sociology, right, that we have identified in drug addiction, substance abuse research that is focused on the stages of a person's drug career. And so, you know, there's the initiation stage where we all experiment, right, or everybody experiments with drugs. Then there is the escalation stage where the individual begins to use more frequently. There's the maintenance stage where the person is able to maintain that use. But then there becomes the problematic stage. It starts to affect everything around that person's life, their jobs, their families. And the use becomes the most important thing in that person's life.
And so, you imply, though, that this is the sort of the common pathway.
Trajectory, yes.
But, I mean, it doesn't have to be.
No,
Speaking for myself, when I came here, I did the experimenting, and then I had some horrendously nasty experiences, and that just drove me away, luckily,
yes,
I suppose.
Yes, and there's the whole idea of a person matures out, you know, which is another theory in sociology, the maturing out theory, which the person eventually gets to the maintenance stage and may get to the problematic stage, but they realize, you know, that it's becoming more problematic and they kind of mature out of it, you know, as they age. But there, I think different people, different populations have different experiences. And one of the things for Latinos, for Mexican-American men in particular, who are heroin users, I have found that they get to that problematic stage, but with the, you know, the help of, not the help, but with family kind of facilitating and enabling them, they come back to the maintenance stage. So it's, you know, it's not a linear process. You know, it can change.
Reminds me, have you, being here on the border, have you ever read Labyrinth of Sorrow by Octavio Paz?
I have not.
I make my students read it if they can. You know, he won a Nobel Prize in 1968
yes.
for literature, and it's all about what you're talking
yes.
about, really, not drugs, but
yeah.
the Mexican society and the families and all that's mm-hmm. extremely interesting. And I think it's something useful to what you're talking about.
Yeah, and that's something that, I mean, it is a controversy when you talk about how the family, the Latino family, can serve as an enabler. But at the same time, it serves also maybe potentially as a protective factor because families do not stigmatize the drug addict, Latino families. And it, to a certain sense, especially if you're talking about intergenerational use, which we see a lot in Mexican-American communities, it becomes kind of normalized. And adolescents, kids are kind of exposed to that. So I think, you know, and this, like I said, this is very controversial that are you saying, well, that, you know, it's normal to use drugs in the Mexican-American family? No, I'm saying that it's a small population of our community. But the families, for some reason, especially when we're talking about intergenerational use, serve as a protective factor.
So do you see the same for other minority populations? I mean, in the African-American community, where certain aspects of the family is also very powerful,
sure.
you see the same idea?
We see the same patterns. And the role model that, or the person in the family that has a lot of the influence among drug users is the grandmother. We see grandmothers in the African-American community as being, you know, the enablers and kind of being the protectors of the generation under them.
And mainly of the grandsons? I mean,
grandsons and, well, see, now we're talking gender roles.
Right.
You know, we're talking gender roles.
Well, that was my question in Octavio Paz for the Hispanic
yeah.
community. Is the treatment or your experience with the males and the females different?
Very
because
different.
Because the family is very different
yeah.
approach. Please
yes.
talk about that.
So gender roles in the Latino community. For males, especially in Mexican Americans that my work has focused on, it's kind of seen as, you know, somebody who is a drug user who has been incarcerated for possession comes out, you know, after a few years of doing time. And that person kind of has this warrior status in the community. It's like, oh, mijo came back, you know, he's doing great. For females, though, it becomes very much more stigmatized. The woman, and I think it's related to the fact that women have this dual role of being a mother, being, you know, a drug user. And so those roles obviously, you know, are in conflict. They're seen as la mala mujer. They're seen as women who have chosen drug use over their children. So for women, it is very, very stigmatizing when they come back and reenter the community. And so unfortunately, you know, we see this bias when it comes to gender.
Which is an ancient culture that really goes back there, too.
You're listening to Science Studio. We're having a fascinating conversation here with Alice Cepeda from the University of Southern California, talking about drug addiction, talking about some of the aspects of the Latino family, which are very interesting. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. On a July day in 1881, President James Garfield arrived at a D.C. train depot.
Two shots rang out. The newly elected president was struck in the back, targeted by a disgruntled lawyer.
But what actually killed President Garfield began with the doctors who first treated him and the care he received leading up to his death 2 months later.
Immediately after the shooting, doctors began probing Garfield's wound, looking for the bullet, but neglected a step vitally important in medicine today. They didn't bother washing their hands or the instruments they used, leaving the president vulnerable to fatal infection.
After determining the bullet wasn't in a fatal spot, they moved the president to the White House, where an incompetent physician, Dr. Willard Bliss, took over. He delayed surgery and forced Garfield to eat rich meals and drink a great deal of alcohol.
Since the X-ray had not been invented yet, Bliss continued to manually probe the wound several times a day looking for the bullet, but never disinfecting his hands first. Bliss was aware of the importance of hand washing because for years an English surgeon, Joseph Lister, had urged doctors to adopt this simple practice to prevent infection. Yet American doctors resisted this as too much trouble.
Soon the president developed a fever and began vomiting. The once strong man lingered in agony until his death from a massive infection on September 19, 1881.
Sadly, an autopsy showed the bullet was not in a fatal spot. Though the shooter was hung, it was an incompetent physician that ultimately killed President Garfield.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Ross Chianelli, Alice Cepeda from the University of Southern California, talking about addiction in many ways, in particular how Alice sees it affecting the Latino family. Let's get to something a little different. One always thinks that when you're into drugs, it's a downward spiral. You talked about being able to get to the maintenance level and then somehow escaping it or an escape velocity like a rocket from the Earth. But is it always clear that getting into things like heroin is just bad for your health, for example? Does the addiction automatically lead to a sort of progressive decrease in health?
Yes, and I think when we talk about different types of drugs, there is research out there that shows a deterioration in your overall general health. So the physiological consequences are pretty detrimental when we're talking about, for instance, cocaine use. Interestingly, with heroin, this is something that is very if you were to talk to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, you know, they would never
admit this, but it's okay.
But heroin, even among populations who have been using heroin for years, we see overall general health as being better than general populations from surveys. And I can attest to this because we did a study in Houston where we interviewed approximately 175 Mexican-American aging heroin users. And the age range was the youngest was 45, the oldest was 80. So these are men who have been using heroin. I think the mean age of heroin was, 35 years. And they had better overall health conditions when it came to chronic conditions like hypertension, diabetes, et cetera. But where they were doing bad was obviously associated with the lifestyle of heroin use, which was hepatitis C, infections with skin abscesses.
Just for those of us who don't know exactly.
Yeah, violence.
How do you take heroin? What's the sort of the methodology of repute?
So there are two. There's smoking. And in South Texas, it's primarily black tar heroin. But there also is brown heroin, which our younger generation of users are snorting or sniffing.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two primary routes of administration for heroin use in
well,
South
let,
Texas.
Well, let me ask you this. This leads to this question I've been dying to ask, too, okay?
I hope I have an answer.
Well, why not make it a health problem instead of a crime? There's a lot of people that say it'd be a lot cheaper and just make it a health problem.
Well, I personally see myself, I'm a sociologist, yes, but I see myself as a public health advocate, a public health researcher, in that I don't perceive drug use as a crime, right? And that, I think that's what society should really be focusing on and looking at it more as a public health condition. So we're hoping that a lot of the research that we produce on this will lead to that. Unfortunately, we're not, especially with these large, huge incarceration rates in our state, in Texas.
It goes back to, you read these stories about Victorian women in the, using laudanum and here in El Paso, the opium dens used to be here when the Chinese were building the railroads and all that kind of stuff. So please comment on some of that.
Well, and I think we're still seeing a lot of that. There was a lot of scapegoating, a lot of, like you said, the Chinese and the opium dens, the Mexicans and marijuana use. And I think we still continue to see who are the ones that are getting incarcerated, black, Latino men who tend to be using you know, marijuana or cocaine out on the streets in their low-income communities, and not the white upper-class CEO who is snorting a line of coke.
Which brings us then to the way different societies handle this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the United States is really quite a well, it was founded on religious principles, and so there is such a thing as evil. There is such a thing as punishment for crime, and at the moment, drug consumption and utilization is criminal. Where do you see better attitudes around the world to this whole? Because it's not just an American problem.
We have some heroin parks in Europe, right? Yeah. And I think in was it Vancouver?
Vancouver, yes. Mm. Actually, I would say who we should look to are some European countries, like for instance the Netherlands and Canada. You know, you mentioned Russ, Vancouver, and I think we are light years away in the United States.
Well, tell us what they're doing. What is groundbreaking?
In Vancouver in particular, especially related to my interest, is the heroin kind of shooting dens, I guess, that they have created, these public spaces where you have its public little compartments, you know, made out of stainless steel.
It's called Heroin Park, right?
Yes, I think it is. And so you as a heroin – if you're a heroin user and you want to go inject in a safe environment, you go into one of these places. There's – I believe there's clean needles. There's nurses standing by in case, you know, somebody overdoses. So you're in a confined area where it's safe to be able to inject and not be out in an alley sharing needles with other users.
Do you have to bring your own heroin, or is that sort of provided there?
No,
own,
you bring your own.
You bring your own.
Yes, you bring your own dose. Right. Yes. So, I mean, but those are very progressive ideas.
But let me ask you another question. I was remember this very well when I was first here. I was in Mexico City, and there was a Mexican woman politician who was being interviewed in English. And the interviewer asked her, well, you know, we have this problem. Don't you think we should legalize it? I can never forget her answer. Her answer was, if you legalize it, you'll have to give us $50 billion more a year in foreign aid because it helps the whole country financially.
And actually, Mexico has decriminalized personal use.
Of heroin?
Personal use of any drug. I think it happened about a year and a half ago. Whether it's been challenged and whether the police on the ground level actually are implementing this or not is still up.
if you're carrying material with you for personal use.
It's
like when Englishmen go across the channel, they can buy beer. All right,
yes.
And it's much cheaper because there's no tax.
Yes.
And so you're allowed to bring back what is enough for personal use. Well, people go over with campers and bring back barrels and gallons of beer, and they say, oh, well, I drink a lot.
Yeah.
So who's the pusher? Who's the distributor?
But what's interesting in Mexico is that I've been doing research in Mexico for the past 2 years with crack users in Mexico City and some of the toughest neighborhoods. And you ask these users, these current users, well, do you know about this new law, about the decriminalization of personal use? And they don't know about it. So, you know, whether it's being implemented, whether it's been tried in a court of law, that still hasn't happened, I don't think.
Well, let's go on to you personally then. I mean, Russell and I both do research in our laboratories and sometimes on the computer, but we don't get out there and mix with the people that we're looking at or investigating, so to speak. And this must be quite dangerous in a sense. If you've got to go to some of the more undesirable, quote-unquote, areas of big cities, do you ever feel danger?
I've been doing this for years. I was actually in Juarez researching prostitutes, and I felt very comfortable. Obviously, you know, I don't show up dressed the way I am right now, but you have to think about little things like that. You have to be aware of your surroundings. And in our most recent study on crack users in Mexico City, NIH was very concerned about our safety. But I think you establish rapport, you establish trust with this community. And the way you do that is by, you know, hanging out with them in their own environments. We tend to always use strategies. For instance, we are not interested in the drug market. We are not interested in who you're buying it from, who your supplier is. We are public health researchers. So our questions tend to focus on the health aspects and the social aspects.
That's an interesting question. What really is the goal of your work? Or is it just to find out and at least we know how it's occurring and where it's occurring and what the issues are? Or is there some other final goal to this?
Yes. Yeah, so my research has primarily been social epidemiology, understanding the nature and the context of drug use. So that's what we would identify as just kind of basic knowledge, basic sociology. I have done programs based on that initial social epidemiology research that has taken it to another level, which is providing treatment and or interventions. So we have done research, research and service, research slash service, where we are providing primarily family-based drug treatment. And these are kind of more clinical studies where we have a control group and an experimental group. And one of the most recent ones was using a brief strategic family therapy with adolescents with drug problems. So I see my work not only creating kind of the base knowledge of it, but also using it to implement interventions and treatment.
So is there a big difference between the issues that arise in, say, Mexico City than in the inner core of Los Angeles, for example?
We're still analyzing the data in Mexico City. It was primarily a qualitative study, meaning, you know, we got narratives from all of these users. But we don't see a lot of difference. We see the difference in terms of crack use, because crack use among Latinos here in the United States is not very common. But in Mexico, and that's what we're trying to understand, how has crack use emerged and diffused? But in general, the environment, the context, the experiences, the challenges, the barriers are the same in Mexico and or, you know, inner city.
You know, there's so many studies about that. It's just fascinating. I was reading one the other day about the gangs in their territories. And these scientists were using models that had been developed for ants in their colonies. And they fit exactly.
Yeah. And we've used some of that in terms of sampling, capture, recapture. That was done with wild animals. And so we're using kind of the same ideas to recruit and sample our population.
The legalization issue. I mean, our local congressman now came up with this idea, as at least to think about it a few years ago when he was a city councilor. What's the general feeling in sociology about this issue?
Well, I think there are some of us that believe that, you know, the legalization of marijuana may be the answer to not everything, but some of the issues.
You know, some of the communities, like the black community, saying this was genocide if we legalize it.
I don't know. I think the legalization may help these minority communities. But like, for instance, the medical marijuana policies are actually focused more, I think, on middle class working class kids. I don't think it's our underclass kids that are going out and getting prescriptions. So I think we need to talk more about this.
Alice Cepeda, great to have you here on Science Studio, and I admire what you are doing very much so, and wish you great luck, and come back and tell us in 10 years what have you discovered and how we're going to go about improving our environment.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alice. Thank you very much to Norman Martinez, our producer.
And thank you for listening, and we will be back next week with another riveting show. Take care. Bye-bye.
Rojas with your Synapse Flash. New Mexico State University is presenting a free community event titled Understanding the Affordable Care Act. The event offers continuing education units. General health certificates will be available as well. The event happens May 1st at the Las Cruces Convention Center. Register via Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.